Hi, and welcome to Prosody, WESA's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Jane McCafferty, guest host of Prosody, and my guest today is the writer Geeta Kothari. Geeta Kothari is the nonfiction editor of the Kenyon Review and director of the Writing Center at University of Pittsburgh. She's also a longtime instructor at Kenyon Review's Summer Adult Workshop in both fiction and nonfiction. Her fiction and nonfiction have appeared in various anthologies and journals, including New England Review, The Kenyon Review, Massachusetts Review, Great Jones Street, and others. Her essay, If You Are What You Eat, Then What Am I?, is widely taught in universities and has been reprinted in several anthologies, including in Best American Essays. She's co-founder of www.novelworkshop.org, formerly Kenyon Review Novel Workshop. Welcome, Geeta.
Hey, Janie.
How are you? Congratulations on a great book.
Thank you so much.
I'd like to start out by telling you this is a really interesting book in terms of how varied the stories are. And I'm curious as to how some of these stories came to be. And I know that you worked with the writer Nancy Zafris, otherwise known as Zafris the Great, down at the Kenyon Workshop. I know that you consider her really instrumental in your path as a writer, so I thought we could start there, because it's clear to me that, unlike some story writers, really look at each story as its own occasion, and it gives you, you know, a really interesting breadth of subject matter and of form in this collection. So do you want to talk about how you got on that path and maybe about Nancy and Kenyon?
Sure. I mean, I think it's almost impossible for me to talk about this collection without talking about Nancy and the Kenyon Review Writers Workshop, because when I decided to take a class there, I had known Nancy for many years by then, and we would see each other occasionally, but not spend huge amounts of time together. And she told me, she said, we started this new workshop at the Kenyon Review, you should come. And I was like, I hate workshops. And I do.
You probably met her at Pitt, right?
I met her at Pitt when she taught at Pitt many, many years ago in the 90s. I mean, you were still here at Pitt, right? Yeah. And it was a long time ago, but Nancy is one of those people who I didn't know at the time never forgets, especially if you were kind to her. Mm-hmm. She also doesn't forget if you weren't, but she really doesn't forget.
No, she doesn't. Yeah.
And she's very, very loyal. And I had stopped writing stories for a while because I was working on a novel. My parents had died, and the novel was just a way to really escape that. You know, I just really wanted to get out of my life. And I'd also felt like I didn't really have a sense of how to work on my stories efficiently. They were taking a very, very long time. And I remember thinking, if it's going to take me 5 years to write a story, I might as well write a novel, and maybe I'm a novelist. Mm-hmm. So she said, come to our workshop. And I had won a teaching award, the David and Tina Bellett Teaching Award at Pitt in 2004. And I had this money left over that I needed to spend on something to advance my teaching. And I thought, well, a workshop might do that. So I went thinking, I'll just write a little bit. I'll see what it's like. And it just really changed everything for me. It's really hard to explain, because it is why I'm working at the Kenyon Review, because I was there. I don't know if they would have considered me for an editorship if, you know, I hadn't been showing up and they hadn't gotten to know me, specifically David Lynn. But he had published me, so I don't know. It was just a very intense experience. As you know, you've taught there. But for me, it was really, it broke down a lot of my defenses. And it really forced me to go to places as a writer I had never been to before. And Nancy is very inventive with her prompts. And the way the workshop is set up is you basically have an assignment every day, and you write it, and you go in the next day to workshop, and you read it out loud. And then Nancy will comment on it.
Are there stories in this book that come specifically from prompts that Nancy gave you?
Yes, there are several, and they're pretty crazy. So,
how about the airplane story?
Flight attendants, take your seats. That was crazy. So the prompt was, this is so insane, there's no way to repeat this. She gave me a month's worth of entries from one of those page a day calendars, you know, those tips. Yeah. And this was golf tips.
because she loves golf.
She does. So it was golf tips. And we also were given these orange clipboards with pharmaceutical stuff written on the back of them. They were like promotional things for some pharmacy. And she gave them to us and said, okay, go write a story. And this was the second workshop I took. I had no idea what to do. And this is how I feel with all her prompts. At a certain point, I'm like, there's no way I'm getting out of this. And someone asked me, how did you write? And I said, I was so scared. I had one beer and then I went back to my dorm room and I wrote. And this uses the language of the golf card, okay. Instructional language.
Wow. I've asked you this before, but that story was so convincing to me that I thought, okay, Gita went and hung out with these people in this airplane. And, you know, but then you said, no, this is completely invented.
It is. Here's the non-invented part of the story. There was a period in my life when I really wanted to be a flight attendant. So my husband wanted to make sure all of you understood that's the autobiographical part.
I can kind of see you as a very droll kind of flight attendant.
I got talked out of that idea by a friend of mine who said you would just be a waitress in the air getting your butt pinched and wiping up people's vomit and not getting tips. So why would you want to do that? I know, she really killed it for me. When you put it like that, it was the vomit that was really bothersome to me. But, and I have been to Gander just for a couple of days. Like I spent a whole month there soaking it up. And that was it. And the thing about writing these prompts is all this stuff from your life. It's not like you're sitting in your room at home with all your journals, right? You just have to pull stuff out of your head to get to the story.
In one day. I mean,
in one night, basically, like, yeah, you know, yeah. It's not like you have oodles of time to do this.
Yeah.
So you just start writing.
Right.
And you have no time to sit around and wait for the perfect thing to come together.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that's what you needed. I mean, as a writer,
that's exactly
who was
what I needed.
Struggling with form and trying to stop writing the 5-year story.
Right. I needed a couple of 1-month stories.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So would you like to read for us?
Sure. I'm going to read just the beginning of Flight Attendants Take Your Seats. When the American military jet took off, the sound filled the empty skies and reverberated through the city. In the seminar room at the Gander Aviation Training Institute, the table shook. The students grabbed their plastic cups of iced water, their notebooks, their reading glasses. The takeoffs were sporadic, and each one was a surprise. The room, a carpeted, windowless cave, looked like it would be soundproof, but it was not. The average flight attendant does not improve flight by flight, Valerie said. She had short, poofy blonde hair and zero sense of humor. Right, Alex? Alex was under the table looking for his pen. He sat up quickly. Ignoring his spinning head, he whispered to his neighbor, John, "Lend me a pencil." Valerie had already interrupted herself twice to ask him a question, which he had answered correctly. But he knew she didn't take him seriously, and he wanted to prove she was wrong. He was paying attention. He would graduate at the top of this class. He would be her first choice for one of the 2 coveted internships. Flying colors, no pun intended, he had told John the night before. Some of their classmates didn't even have a bachelor's degree. Valerie herself had gone straight from high school to a job at one of the major airlines. She refused to say which one. Surely he, Alex, was smarter than an aging stewardess with secretary hair. Use the word stewardess in front of her, John said, and you'll be going home on the first flight out of here. I was being ironic, Alex said. He didn't expect John to understand. He was too old for a start, nearly 50, and he was American. With his droopy eyes, long face, and deep voice, he looked and sounded like Eeyore. You have to be prepared for plateaus, Valerie said. It is during one of these plateaus that you will have to deploy your best serving skills, holding a cup of Diet Coke without spilling it on 3C while you reach across for 3A. If you're in first class or on an international flight, it will have to be a steady hand pouring that wine, not to mention the after-dinner coffee and tea. Valerie looked at the 20 people sitting at the table and blinked. She blinked often and slowly, like a doll, and it was unclear if this was for emphasis or because she had dry eyes. Nothing beats practice, Valerie said. The Institute was in a strip mall not far from the Gander International Airport. The month-long course was guaranteed to prepare its students for the highly competitive airline interview. The only guarantee of getting a job, however, was one of the two internships at an unnamed airline. According to the Institute's brochure, interns always went on to well-paid corporate jobs. No messing around in the commercial sector, cleaning up vomit on the Dubuque to Albuquerque route. Private jets, well-heeled clients, exotic destinations. That's what the students sitting at the long oval table wanted. They followed Valerie's PowerPoint presentation closely, most of them taking notes, even though she had given them a thick manual to study in the evenings. Two internships, 20 students. The math was inescapable.
I feel like that's a story that anybody who's ever been stuck in that little microcosm of a new job where there's all this stuff to learn, you just have to put up with it and put up with all these characters. It's a story that's really easy to enter because I think it's about this airline, but it's also just about being young and trying to figure out what you're doing and trying to learn.
Have a lot of empathy. I have a lot of empathy for those young characters.
Mm-hmm. Right? Yeah, you do.
I do remember being like that. And sometimes when I enter these stories, I feel like, oh, this is my chance to relive that horrible part of my life that I really don't want to revisit, but I'm going to anyway.
Well, because you find the humor. I mean, that's one reason. And that's another question I had for you, because I really loved so much of the humor in these stories when I was rereading them. For instance, Lally, the character who's a kindergarten teacher, I think she's such a funny character because she's so ill-suited in a way to her job. Even if she's wonderful, she's, you know, the kids are all excited. At one point, she's, you know, they're asking her to tell them a story. And she says something like, okay, I will, if you promise not to get on my nerves, which is just like such a funny image of this kindergarten teacher. And then, you know, of course, they turn her into a storyteller. It's a great, I love that story. And then the humor, there's humor in almost every story. I found something that really made me laugh. The last story with the brother and the sister, I think you're so good at depicting how that sibling relationship can continue well into adulthood. Having the sister say to the brother, you're not the boss of me, though she's, you know, a grown woman. She's a doctor. But her relationship with her brother is arrested at that level. And it's really fun. That whole story is comic. So I guess I wanted you to talk about how humor functions in the stories or why it's important to you and how it might give you a way into these characters.
I think the absurdity of some of these situations really interests me. So it's not like I'm going in there saying, oh, I'm going to write a funny story. In fact, I wish I were funnier. And I'm really
glad you see
some humor in them. I mean, sometimes I feel like I'm just too bleak. But there are just those little moments where I think, this is just absurd. And how would this person react? And I think in some ways, writing myself into that absurd corner.
Yeah.
Forces that humor. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. It's like there's nowhere else to go.
Mm-hmm. But it's really subtle. You know, it's, I think,
yeah,
it really emerges.
Ha, ha, ha.
It emerges out of the characters, and it's pretty subtle. The other thing that I thought we could talk about is how much homesickness runs through the stories. I think there are different kinds of homesickness, but that to me is something that, not that a story collection needs to have a unifying theme, thematic concern, or anything like that. I see stories as their own occasion, but I do feel like this collection does have a kind of deep unifying theme that isn't on the surface, but that it's about homesickness. It's about yearning for connection to place and time that is gone, that is elusive. I mean, we have that mother who changed herself to the gate because eminent domain is coming in. We have the story collection starting off with that wonderfully quiet and moving story where the woman is trying to fit into her husband's family and has an aunt in Erie who's Indian and who represents for her family. But both the husband's family and the aunt are elusive and not enough grounding. And so maybe talk about that sense of homesickness and what informs it and how you're working with it as a writer.
Well, I do think that creeps into the stories. And as you know, theme is something that often you usually just discover after reading. You don't
oh, yeah.
really enter into it, which is why I'm always interested in collections that are thematically unified in a very clear way. And I always wonder, you know, did the writer know exactly what they were doing when they started this collection? Because I felt like I do enter each story as its own occasion. But I think my concerns or my terrain over the years, and this is, you know, over 35 years of writing, is home. Mm-hmm. I mean, it just has become a present thing in all my writing. Mm-hmm. And I see it mostly in the nonfiction, of course, where I endlessly mine my poor parents and their lives and mm-hmm. our lives together. And
just negotiating what it means to be first generation.
I think if you're first generation and you're growing up in this time where you can be at home in multiple places, and I would say even anyone who's mobile, right? It's very difficult to know what your landscape is necessarily, mm-hmm. or to have a really solid sense of your landscape. So, you know, when I read a collection like Among the Missing by Dan Shaun, mm-hmm. I feel like he has a really clear sense of the landscape of these stories mm-hmm. and where these people belong and what they're coming from. And I don't necessarily have that. Mm-hmm. They seem to me, my characters can come from almost anywhere.
Yeah, which is interesting. But they feel that, I think, pretty keenly. That sense
and I think that's me feeling it, mm-hmm. right? That, yeah. Oh my God, you're from Canada. Why are you here in my collection?
Or so many people from Canada, Gita? Yes, she told me to ask that question.
You know, I spent a lot of time with Canadians over the last 25 years observing them close up. My husband's.
You're married.
Yeah, because I'm married to one. And I do find his family very interesting and intriguing. And there are no stories directly based on any of them, but it's always interesting.
In. Yeah. Do you want to read for a couple minutes from another story?
Yeah, I'll read from another story. Okay, so this is Foreign Relations. If asked, Mina wouldn't have said she followed him to the store, trailed him like a bloodhound after a fox, sniffing the air for the scent and taste of him. No, that wasn't the way she remembered it. What happened, history as she remembered it, was that she saw him riding his bike, his precious titanium mountain bike, in the direction of the Stop and Shop at the end of King Street. She had been planning to go there anyway, and as she came out of the Dunkin' Donuts, she saw him ride past. He was wearing his black wraparound sunglasses and worn topsiders with no socks, though the temperature had plummeted the night before, turning the islands of grass in the sidewalk into stiff frozen needles that crunched underfoot. And no, she wouldn't have been able to tell anyone, not even herself, how she came to know his bicycle was precious, or that it was a mountain bike, or that it was titanium. How she came by the details of this man with green eyes and a coarse blonde ponytail was a mystery to her. She didn't realize she had them, carried them around in the back pocket of her jeans like forgotten tissues and old grocery lists that shredded in the wash and attached themselves to every other piece of clothing in the load. These details hung like the pills on a cheap sweater that multiplied on their own. They were part of her now. Useless details that offered no insight as to why Larry had disappeared in the middle of his first year at the hospital. About him, she thought she knew what everyone else knew. Threadbare scraps. Mayflower descendant, son of a famous New York district judge, Harvard graduate, 1 year of law school, a broken heart, maybe two, several stepfamilies, and a passion for the outdoors. He skied and backpacked in remote areas of the world. He enjoyed skydiving, hang gliding, and kayaking in white water. Mostly, though, he climbed mountains, and his skin was always tanned, ruddy from a life lived close to nature. When she thought of America, the image of Larry floated by, next to billboards for the Marlboro Man and Coca-Cola. Her skin was also tan, but she'd been born with it, and was often mistaken for a Seminole Indian in Florida, where her parents had moved after one harsh New York winter. East Indian, she learned to call herself, but the blank eyes of her classmates made her wish she could say Seminole, Apache, Cherokee, something they'd at least seen on TV and could believe existed. And later, as she grew up, it was elephants and maharajas and poverty she had to explain to her classmates at the New England boarding school her parents sent her to. 6 years passed, and then she stayed for college and med school. Unlike her tropical parents, she had learned to love the crisp winter air, the peculiar light that deadened the earth just before snow fell from the sky. Loving the cold was different from being cold. Accordingly, she loved the accoutrements of the cold. Nubby wool sweaters, thick black tights, long sleeves, high necks, fingerless gloves, and sheepskin slippers. She bought heavy socks and turtlenecks and leggings in catalog colors of summer. Fuchsia, harvest green, and lapis lazuli.
Nice. This story goes to such an interesting place, and you use point of view in a fascinating way. When the doctor goes to India at the end and dies there, and she invents this death and imagines so vividly what happens to him in the mountains. And I mean, obviously, it's about her obsession or fascination with somebody who has this unchecked privilege and, you know, is completely unaware of that sense of himself moving through the world and so entitled. But I ended up feeling like there was such an intimacy in her conjuring him through imagination, even though it was completely resentful. And like, that was a really interesting combination of how close she seems to him there at the end through imagination. And I thought it was really an achievement. I felt he was so believable too, and that it was a little risky because he could have been just a cliche. But how do you think you avoided that? Like, how do you think you made him so real on the page?
I don't know. You know, he started off as a much more cartoon-like character. He had a different name, you know, and he was a drunk, and he had a pot belly. He was completely unattractive. And kind of a caricature of the racist jerk on a bike. And that wasn't interesting to me. It was really hard to sustain that story and make it work. And I realized maybe it was because of something Chuck Kinder said to me, actually. He happened to read a draft of this, and I can't remember exactly what he said, but it was something about the relationship between her and this character. And I realized she kind of resented him, but also wanted what he had. She wanted that ability to move freely through the world. And so I couldn't make him so unattractive, but it wasn't even conscious at that point. When I changed him, it started to change the story. You know, this story was informed very, very obviously to me, it seems, by some of the friends I had at the time who were mountain climbers or climbers, and the debates we would have about the John Krakauer book, Into Thin Air. You know, we spent a lot of time talking about it. And I was I'm a big Krakauer fan, but I also feel very keenly that he's able to write these stories because he's able to go to places that a woman and a woman of color might not be able to get to and get the stories that aren't available to people like me. So I think that was influenced by that quite a bit.
Interesting. So I wanted to ask you why you titled your book I Break for Moose. I don't think you've told me that.
I don't think I did. And in fact, the one person I told said, that's a terrible title. And I said, I know, I got a little bit of judgment on that.
Hey, but you stuck with it, so there must be a reason.
I did stick with it because, first of all, I like the idea of moose, which are not native to Indians or Indian people, appearing on the same cover as a very Indian name. It's just like, this is just incongruous. And I feel like so much of my life is absurd and incongruous. It doesn't make sense to me. So I like that. And the title, if when you see the cover of the book, which is not the cover on the galley, the title has movement behind it. And one of the things a friend of mine who read this collection noticed, he said, you know, all your characters are in cars, or there was a story with someone on a boat at one point that I took out. They're all moving. There's very little staying in one place for a long period of time. And in fact, I'm really stunned by how many people are in cars, because I think that's kind of a bad place to start a story. You can just end up sitting in the car all day thinking about things and never getting anywhere. And it's really
hard. I've heard other people say that too.
Nancy.
Nancy said, don't put your characters in cars.
And half of the stories I wrote for her were people in cars.
Wow. I used to always put characters in cars too.
But I think you have to be able to you have to be aware of the pitfalls of doing that. And I think you're a good enough writer to carry it off. And
I guess because if you're in a car, you're just stationary. You're trapped there. You can't use movement, motion. You can't use you can't walk into the other room, right? So that's what people are saying. Heather, what's her name? Sellers? Heather mm-hmm. Sellers. She visited, and that's one of the things that she said. Get your people out of cars. Put them in.
It's really
put them
hard.
In rooms.
It I think it's hard for, especially for beginning writers, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Because what to that put, becomes yeah. is the whole. The story isn't in the car. You have to make the story in the car.
Right. Like, what's the story by Tobias Wolff? It's the father and the son. I think it's a snow powder. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is a really wonderful story. And it does take place in the car. But that narrator is so good at letting us in on the deeper story.
That bottom story.
Yeah.
Right.
Right. Right.
So that was the reason for the title, because the motion.
The absurdity and the motion.
The yeah.
Yeah. And that, you know, it titles the story that picks up on a lot of the themes
right.
from the other stories. So, Gita, could you read some of the story called Her Mother's Ashes?
Sure. I'm just going to read the beginning. She hears the children at the front door before she sees them. They rush into the hall, a mass of slickers and rubber boots squeaking and slipping across the floor. Lolly remembers when raincoats came only in yellow, and suddenly she feels old. From the room, Lolly watches them tear their coats off, struggle with their outdoor shoes, grabbing onto each other or the wall for support, laughing and breathless. Yoki trips into the classroom, still wearing her red galoshes. When she started working at the after-school program, Lolly told the children that while growing up, she wasn't allowed to wear shoes in the house. The one exception was the time her parents went to Boston and brought back a pair of red Oxfords for her. They were new and clean, shiny and beautiful. She'd worn them to bed that night. Her parents didn't know they were called Oxfords. For years, the shoes were simply Boston shoes, the only shoes she ever wore indoors. Yoki, Lolly calls out, anxious to get her, before she takes another step into the clean classroom. Yoki looks up. Don't you want to put on your slippers? Lolly asks. The children take their shoes off when they come in and put on the slippers lined up under their pegs in the hallway. She doesn't want to tell Yoki what to do, but the order is implicit in her question, said in a tone used only with children. Yoki looks down at her feet, as if surprised to see her outdoor shoes still there. Before Lolly knows it, they are standing around her, their strange little voices trying to drown each other out. Some of them have surprisingly low voices, as if they've been staying up late at night with a bottle of whiskey and a pack of cigarettes. They are short enough to trip her without trying. Looking down at them, she feels very tall and awkward, not old, but young now, like an unsure teenager. Tell us about the 1,000-ton man again, please, Lolly, please. 1,200-pound man, she says automatically, and then wonders what difference accuracy makes to a story culled from the National Enquirer and the Evening News. Whatever. Tell me what he eats. I told you yesterday, Davy. Davy is giggling behind his hands. He loves the story, as do his 10 giggling cohorts standing in a rough semicircle at her feet. Okay, she sighs. Why do children love to hear the same story again and again? But only if you promise, all of you, not to get on my nerves.
The writing of Gita Khatari. Thanks so much for being here. You've been listening to Prosody, WESA's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty. Our sound engineers are Michelle Stoner and Lisa Alexander. Please tune in every Saturday morning at 6:30 for Prosody 90.5 WESA.